There we go.
It's good, this, isn't it? It's picking up in all this atmos, is it?
No, and it picks up with about 2 or 3 feet. So Serena George, once again, a new pony radio with young Barry Quine. It's fantastic. I love my little machine. Yeah, so was it something, again, I think that fascinates people generally, is this thing about, we'll start off with you. If you're writing for one...
Well, I don't anymore.
When you
cast
did.
Cast my mind back.
When you were writing for one comic, would that preclude you from maybe working with another? Would they go, oh, we don't
want to... No. No. No, we were all over the place. We were promiscuous.
So when you
and
wrote,
they all knew what we were doing. We were right in front of
because it's
we
a small world. Yeah. So if you were writing for Frankie Howard and then Larry Grayson, for instance, said, would you write something, you would have no problem with that.
You might. It didn't happen. I don't know what I don't think I'd have gone into that situation. Because I wouldn't have been able to tell Frankie Howard I was writing for Larry Grayson.
It would have made him cry.
It never happened.
Right.
No, you were up front. They all knew what you were doing, and generally they understood. They weren't sort of small-minded about it. The great Eric and Ernie knew that we were off doing stuff with two writers. That was understood.
That was fine. Because one of the things, again, which, you know, I'll talk about...
I was never signed up. I never thought about this, actually. I don't think I was ever signed up on a contract where it was exclusive. You don't write for anybody else. I don't think that ever happened. So that was good. Moonlight about the place, you know, with somebody else.
Which goes into the other area which I find interesting about you and some of your generation is that many have reinvented themselves. Frankie Howard did it just before he died. You know, he came back again, storming just before he died, having
been
in the
wasteland. Well, Peter Vincent, an old friend of mine and writing partner, we went to that, I think, the last television he did, Oxford Uni.
The Oxford University.
We were there.
Which is brilliant, yeah.
We were there, and Ian Davidson, another friend, I met at the interval, and we were sitting on very uncomfortable wooden benches, and Ian said, I don't know where Peter had got to at that moment, but he said, Baz, come in the library, and you can watch it on the screen and sit in an armchair. So I said, oh, I'll have a bit of that. So it was great. I watched the second half, relaxing with a drink in an armchair. But in the second half, Frankie made a reference to me, and the camera cut to an empty seat. Where's he gone?
No, because it's something I find really interesting. Again, I'll just mention, you don't have to join in, but someone like Jimmy Tarbuck, who went really by the wayside because he either couldn't or wouldn't join in with, and I do think comedy's comedy, but he wouldn't come in with the next flow of comics coming through the next generation.
Yeah.
He said, what's all this alternative funny?
Alternative comedy means... I knew what it was alternative to. There was an alternative. It was an alternative to racism. And mother-in-law, and
I think it was just a useful to give something.
It was a
convenient
handle for
what was coming
work.
Through. Yeah.
But I've just rolled along. I've been told this before, which is very pleasant. But I just seem to roll along with each generation. It never occurred to me that you didn't. I think it was the writing. You rolled along with each generation as you were writing. So I always had the same attitude as a performer who's around now. Oh, he's good, she's good. It never really occurred to me that it was a different generation and I was never, I hope to God, I was never an old sexist racist comic. A young stand-up said to me a few years ago in Edinburgh, oh, you're clean. He didn't mean you don't swear or anything. I said, what do you mean I'm clean? He said, well, you've got no baggage. You're not one of them, he said.
Mm, mm, mm.
You didn't do that stuff. Mm. I never did that stuff, you know.
Yeah, no, because I think it's, you know, again, Bruce Forsyth has reinvented himself, having been out of the, he's what, 81?
Yeah.
It's fantastic. He's come back storming
through.
Oh, it's
astonishing. You see, Bruce is always interested in what's happening now. Ronnie Corbett, you know, he became a friend of Harry Hill and Ben Elton earlier, and Ronnie wants to know what's happening. He has a home near Edinburgh, a second home, and he goes to Fringe every year. He goes to shows. He and Bruce came to see me and Ronnie Golden. And there's a great stir about in the building.
I can imagine.
Bruce Forsyth and Ronnie Corbett are here.
Two great war horses of comedy.
And they came to see me and Ronnie Golden, which was just a joy.
But you've also done that in that you've done, you know, the Windmill Theatre with the strippers in London, the panel shows, the writing, the performing. You know, you've actually covered all as many bases as it's possible for one individual
without being
to cover.
Aware of it.
Without being aware of it, exactly.
Maybe just that's like, the trick, I don't know.
Is that, yeah.
I just go with the flow. I've always gone with the flow. Like, you know, when I, post-university, I'm on the road with strippers. I didn't sort of analyse it. I just thought, oh, this is great, I like this. I said I've been dogged by good luck all my life. There's something about being the right time, the right place at the right time. I wrote, even before Beyond the Fringe, there were theatre shows called Reviews that were pretty camp in and theatrical and West End and all that stuff. And I wrote for an actress called Anna Quayle. I wrote a couple of sketches. Danny LaRue comes into the Fortune Theatre and said, who wrote this? I finished up writing his nightclub shows for 13 years. One night, David Frost comes into Danny LaRue's club. Who wrote this? He spotted Ronnie Corbett in the show. And as a result, Ronnie Corbett's suddenly in the Frost Report, and I'm a Frost writer. You know, you can't plan this. You're just in the right place at the right time.
Well, I think you can't plan it, but you can be this sort of personality that will roll with what's going on, because, as I've said, there are some people who've absolutely gone, no, this is the line upon which I will not cross. And they just go, I will not do, join in with these alternative comics and start dishing them.
It never occurred to me.
Yeah.
Never occurred to me. The things about my life I'm not aware of. I was being interviewed recently, and the woman interviewed me said, there's a real gay theme in your career, isn't there? And I said, well, I'm very happy about that. And she said, well, you know, you go right back. Stanley Baxter. Kenny Everett, Danny LaRue, Graham Chapman I wrote with more than anybody outside Python. We wrote over 50 shows, programmes together. There's a lovely, happy gay motif in my career as well. Why not?
Strippers and gay boys.
It's lovely. I'm an old tart.
No, I mean, it's like Paul Merton writing all the fabulous Julian Clary stuff, and, you know, very hard. It works brilliantly.
You know, and Paul's got the same attitude. What's the problem? You haven't got a preconceived idea that you are in that box and you don't go outside. But it never occurred to me. I'm not saying I did a grand thing, oh, I will embrace young comedians, or calculatingly, oh, I must keep in with the young ones. Oh, God, I'm old. I must keep in with the young ones. Oh, God, it's all changing. Never occurred to me at all. They're just mates and people in the same business as me. People were bloody good to me when I was young. I do think I had a feeling that I had a bit of a bargain to repay. People helped me when I was starting, older comics and older writers and people. They were very good to me. And not overconsciously, but I thought, yeah, pay something back. You know, there's young people around and it's tough and it's competitive. It's really heavy now. I mean, when I started, we didn't call it stand-up in those days. I mean, which is the best definition ever, isn't it? Stand-up, that's what you do. We called it, you were a turn or an act or something. But in terms of comedians, there are probably 200 in the country or something. Now there are thousands.
Yeah, I think so. I think
I wouldn't like to be starting now.
15,000.
I really feel for young ones starting now because the competition. Oh God, it's frightening.
But I do think the board's much wider now. Because when you started out, like you said, there was the windmill, and there weren't, where else could you go?
Yes.
There wasn't really anywhere.
Right.
Whereas,
and television. Television was BBC and ITV.
Yeah.
And then there was BBC Two, you know, and then there was Channel 4 through the years. But it was a very closed world. You see, Eric and Ernie, who were brilliant, quite rightly, and people just the other day, there's still a quote about one of their Christmas shows allegedly got 28 million viewers. They were kings, but it's a smaller world. But they still deserve to be kings.
Oh, yes.
But now it's fragmented. Mm. Satellite, blah, 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 everything, you know, and people watching something on their phone and downloading, and it's a different world. Nobody can ever be Eric and Ernie ever again in quite that way, in television terms anyway.
Because, yes, it's impossible to dominate the channels in the same way. Yeah.
And now, of course, you get, you know, the cliche, you know, comedy, it's new rock and roll, whatever. You will get a comedian performing to thousands of people in a stadium or an arena. That's what I see.
Well, also, I mean, as a comic, I don't know whether this was your experience, but I certainly find that I get invited to do the weirdest things that I think this isn't. I love it. I find the broader the better. But a couple of years ago, I did the Shetland Folk Festival. Now, I know bugger all about folk, less about the Shetland Islands, but it was fantastic for a week, standing in front of 800 people, doing whatever needed to be done, and I thought that wasn't, not what I didn't even conceive that that was part of what I was stepping into, whereas now I think that's much, there are all sorts of areas now where people use comedians, and not necessarily directly as comics, which I don't know whether that was so much around in your time.
There's a lot more moving about in the business than I ever remember, people crossing over into other areas and blah, blah, blah. You know, comedians becoming novelists and, you know, all sorts of things.
All straight actors.
Which I think is wonderful.
Yeah.
It was much more rigid in the old days. You were in your box.
Yeah.
That's what you did.
Yeah.
And there's so much more. It's looser now. People are all over the place. And I like that.
Yeah. Well, I think also it allows people to develop that aspect of their comedy. Like someone like Ross Noble. You know, I just think he's a genius, but, you know, his world is something that maybe someone like Frankie Howard couldn't have fitted into, but they're both comics.
Yes, that's right.
Both
and
comics.
I've seen it all, you know, like an observer, you know.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
I'm being close to
the... Ross said to me one day, you know, I refuse the definition comic or comedian. And people say, why are you not a comedian? I said, no. I tell jokes and sing songs. I like the word entertainer. I said, comedians are different. I spent my life working with them. And Ross said to me one day, he said, Baz, he said, what you're doing is so old, it's new. Don't change a thing. None of us tell jokes. And I love what goes on now, you know, the observational and the riffing and all this stuff. And maybe I've got my cosy little corner. He tells jokes and sings songs. And we all tell jokes when we're all together in Edinburgh and all that. The youngsters, everybody, we all love jokes in the bar and everything. But they don't tell them when they're on the stage. They don't tell jokes when they're up there. And I do, which is all I've ever known, really. But I love what they do. I don't think I could do it. Maybe I could. I don't.
Well, Jimmy Carr tells jokes.
Sorry?
Jimmy Carr. Sorry.
Yeah,
there are a few people
what I'm talking
that,
about
what
is
saying,
this man went into a pub with an ostrich. You know what I mean? The joke. I still do the joke.
There's one on the tip of my tongue, but I'm not going to say it because it's a bit naughty. I'll tell you about it afterwards. It's my joke at the moment. I'll tell you a bit later. But what I really enjoy about the comedic world at the moment is that they're really, more than ever before, is horses for courses. You know, people can do whatever they want.
Yeah.
And develop.
I think it's good. And there are very lively minds around now, very creative minds. I'm not saying the old ones weren't. But, I mean, when I started, to be honest, I think some of the people I wrote for were slightly to the right of Darth Vader. You know. They hadn't really thought it through, but they were... Norman Wisdom respect, he's in his 90s, as you know, and not well. But Norman was so fierce. I came from nothing. I made it. So can they. I'm not, you know. And it's really heavy right-wing stuff. And then it became much more to the left or left of centre, even if I think maybe one or two were thinking, well, that's what I've got to do, you know, even if they weren't. And I thought, that's good. And the pendulum swings all over. I mean, people do it as a joke. I mean, Will Smith and Miles Jupp do posh. They do posh. I'm still looking for someone who does really reactionary, well, you probably know better than I do, really reactionary right-wing stuff, but as a joke.
Well, the only person, but he does it from a specific angle, is Scott Capurro.
Sorry?
Scott Capurro.
Oh, Scott. Oh, God. He, doesn't
the home, he doesn't use it anymore, but he used to be the homophobic gay act, didn't he?
Yes.
That was his tag, but he's dropped it now. But
any man who can do a line like, they call me a Holocaust denier. What Holocaust? Oh, he's still, I did loose ends with him a couple of months ago. And of course, even Scott was sort of behaving himself. It was loose ends, pre-recorded now. I love the live days, but and he was still sticking it on them. And going, oh, come on, Scott.
He's one of the few that I would say does the reactionary right wing in a way.
Yes, I never
not
thought
quite,
of that.
Not
yeah,
really the way I know the way you mean.
And I'm gay and homophobic. Yes, it's
fucking hate gay men.
Stir it.
Yeah.
There's a story about loose ends. You have to fill in the background as well. Elaine Stritch years ago when it was live.
Yeah.
And Elaine Stritch, Ned Sherrin was the show. And Elaine Stritch told the story, and the story, I'm paraphrasing, but the story finished like a, and I said, fuck that. Stunned silence in the studio. And she said, can I do that again then? And he said, this is live, darling. She said, oh, shit. And this is years ago. Glorious. All went out.
Yes, Joan Rivers did that recently on the live show, didn't she? She used the F
word. Those women.
Those
women.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, she just beamed. I said, I've never been bounced off a television show on the commercial break. It was wonderful.
But I think actually anyway.
I wrote for her. She did it wasn't that successful. It was almost too American. But she did a series for BBC. We did 6 shows in 7 nights. And Dick Bosworth, great American man, another of my partners, we worked on the show. And I met her Wednesday last week at the Prince Charles thing. I wasn't going to do. Oh, you won't remember me. I wrote a few years, you know, forget it. She came over to me after the show. Hello. I said, hello. She said, there's a book called Pigs Can Fly, which I wrote. Sort of ought to buy it.
Yeah.
And she pointed at the man with her and said, he says I ought to read it. And I said, well, you push my sales into double figures. And we just laughed. And that was the end of that. From nowhere, you know, this big star goes, there's a book called Pigs Can Fly.
Yes, someone else could read it. So is there any line that you would not cross in comedy?
Well, the taboos have all fallen by the wayside. It's the performer, isn't it? I mean, you and I know comedians have talked about cancer and all sorts of things. No, it's not what I do. No, there's a lot of lines I wouldn't cross to do with disability, illness, only because it's not what I do. I have no problem with other people doing it who are really creative and funny about it. No subject is taboo for me. If the performer and the material is right. No, not at all.
Mm.
I have a particular one, I don't. And there are some very funny stories. I never joke about stammering and stuttering, which is not life-threatening at all. But I think, what a misery it must be. That's right, it's my one. Oh, I don't do the heavy stuff, obviously. I don't do cancer and so on. I don't think it would come well from me. They would, they'd get really uncomfortable. They'd go, no, why is he doing it? Is he trying to keep up with the young ones? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like if I swore about it. I love that great word, fuck, you know, and I use it. now and again, but only two or three times at most, usually quoting somebody else. But if I swore, and I think swearing can be very funny, well used, but if I swore, I think the audience would think, oh, he's sad. Oh, he's sad. He's trying to keep up. The young ones, you know. It's only business. It's a conscious decision.
But
and
yes,
I can laugh at somebody who's swearing and love it. But I don't do it. It's not what I do.
Mm. But if you were asked to write with somebody on a subject that you're not comfortable with, you would just say no? Or
I would say that right up front, and then we'd talk about it, and I might be talked round to do it.
Mm.
Oh, I'm open to that. No sort of, you know.
Because about once, yeah. It's about once a year we have the latest sort of scandal on who's overstepped the bound. This year it's Jonathan Ross. 4 years ago it was Billy Connolly with the Ben. What's the point? Ken Bixley, the guy who was decapitated.
Oh, it did.
Remember? It was,
yes,
Billy Connolly.
Bill.
Yeah.
And Bill said, oh, I don't know. Why didn't they get on with it? Like, we can't bear the suspense. Kill him, you know.
Yeah.
And he got
a bad press
on that.
Yeah.
But he said it was just something he said off the top of his head. But then Rich and Judy, of all people, had two men on their show who saw his show two separate nights. He said it both nights. Yes, that poor man got me. Yeah. And you knew that Bill had honed in on a really uncomfortable truth. People going, I can't bear any more of this. He spoke the unspeakable.
Yes.
Why don't they get on with it? You know, and that's what good people do. They go right over the line, you know, it happens.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that, because I think it's sort of one of those endless, I don't know on any of these where I stand on it, because I do think Billy Connolly was saying what he was saying.
I don't stand on a general basis on anything about comedy. It's all to do with the individual moment, the individual case, who said it, when they said it, where they said it. You can't generalise. You can't generalise about it. It's like, you know, I told you the Jonathan Ross Russell thing was, me was anger because they insulted an old friend of mine. That's nothing to do with the principle of the thing.
No, no.
And then I calm down about that and I think, well, my second phase is, wasn't remotely funny. If it had been utterly gross and funny, I'd have had to reassess and gone, well, yeah, but it wasn't remotely funny. Rubbish.
No,
I'd have said, I'm giving you a, if I was a boss, I'd say, I'm giving you a big smack now because that was rubbish.
I remember when I was emceeing a job and the promoter was an absolute nightmare, and she was, I don't know, she was just a nightmare, it doesn't really matter, but I was so angry, and it was boiling
over
the gig started 2 hours late, it went on, and there was hardly anybody on the gig. And then I finally started, and I thought, I've got to find out who's in the audience, because there's so few of them, and at least make it intimate, which is what I'm very good at. And then this couple in the front, they said something like, yes, we saw you last week, you were brilliant. And literally what I did with my hand, I flicked them away and I said, oh, that's okay, you don't matter. Now what I was actually thinking was, oh, that's great, you'll be on board.
Yes.
But the way it came out was completely
the opposite. It's the way it comes out.
And I was just like, oh God. And from then on they looked at me really upset that these little fans had turned up for a second time the same week, and I just gone, oh, you don't matter. What I meant was, great, I don't
what
have to work with
was,
you, it's because you're
that's
so
right.
lovely.
But the way it comes out, oh, we've all suffered from that. No, what I meant was, too late.
You've stomped all over them.
There was a quote from the notorious, can't believe it, this John Sargent should be coming down.
Oh, that's so upsetting.
But, oh, he's a bitch, though, I know him.
Oh, but I love him.
There was a quote, oh, yes, of course.
Clever game.
But he can really do a double-edged compliment. There's a quote from him this morning.
Just John for those Humphreys. Of you who don't know, he's in a television show as a dancer, and he's just resigned because the critics said he was such a rubbish dancer in the show, which, and the audience kept voting to keep him in the show.
John Sargent, personified somebody really screwed up when he was a political correspondent commentator. Somebody really screwed up on camera and really got something really wrong, and they were really desperate afterwards. And John Seldon said to them, "Oh, don't, come on, calm down. We've all nearly done that." That is a killer. We've all done that. We've all nearly done that. I met John in Carnaby Street earlier this year, long before he strictly came down to the fame. Baz. And he's got a camera crew and everything. I said, you're working. He said, "No, we're on a break. So I stood and chatted to him in Carnaby Street. He always has to do it. He said, "God, I admire you." I said, "John." And he said, "No, I've been told you can drink an enormous amount and then stand up and do a great after-dinner speech." He's done the great after-dinner speech, but he has to do the, "You drink an enormous amount." He can't. He plays the game, this man.
He's not a political correspondent for no reason.
He hasn't spent all... And, of course, he started in comedy, didn't he? He was working down in Bennett.
I didn't know that.
Oh, no, he was at Cambridge with Alan. And Alan Bennett's only ever done one TV series ever as a performer in his own right, called On the Margin, many years ago. John Sargent was in it.
Never knew that.
Yep. A young John Sargent, and then he changed direction, went into journalism and politics and blah, blah, blah. No, no, he's never lost that. And I did Call My Bluff. We had an asbestos scare at BBC, so they shunted us all to Pebble Mill in Birmingham. We did Call My Bluff. And John Sargent was on it. And we had a break between the two recordings, and he rather loftily said to some poor woman working on the show, "A glass of white wine, please." None of us had remotely thought about having a drink. We were nowhere near the bar or anything. "Glass of white wine." And he went away, and I said very loudly, "Well, some of us are sergeants and the others are mere corporals and privates," I said. Oh, his ego is in good shape.
Yeah, well, I think he was marvellous. Let's do one more, and then you've got to go home.
This has been a pleasure.
I'm really enjoying it.
Sorry you had Harrow on the Hill first.
I could do more.